Okay, have you got a handout? If anyone got a handout, raise a hand. Brilliant. It worked. Right, if you could keep that that passage open. As with the previous session, we'll kind of jump around a little bit, but we'll actually focus in on this passage quite a lot. What I want to do is having kind of given the big picture, now kind of jump right to the end and think, well, what is the final game plan? Where is God taking the world? What is the goal? And then effectively we'll back up and think a little bit more about what happens on the day of the Lord this evening, when that might be, tomorrow morning, and how we live in the light of it. So that's the schedule. So let's begin by playing word association. Okay? What comes into your mind when I say heaven? Hell? God? Angels? Yep. Fluffy white clouds?
Perfection.
Sorry?
Perfection.
Sorry, what was on over here? Philadelphia cheese. But there, you know, it's the adverts, isn't it? The old, you're in heaven. See, the thing is that while we might think of some good things, actually quite a lot of weird stuff like Philadelphia cheese shows up as well. And the picture you could possibly have in your mind could be something like that, you know. Will you become a little cherub or something? If I ask my daughter to draw a picture of, you know, what we might see in heaven or something, she'd draw something a little bit like that. And you can easily think of being kitted out with halo and wings, sitting on a cloud. I love Gary Larson cartoons. And he actually has some very funny ones, I think, of heaven and, in fact, of hell. And, like, in some ways they're not funny because they're wrong, but some of them are funny. So one of them is this guy sitting, you know, the stereotype view of heaven, sitting on a cloud with wings and a halo, and he's sitting there just kind of staring out. And you can see other people on similar clouds dotted around the sky, all sitting there staring. And the caption underneath says, "Wish I'd brought a magazine." You know. Because that would be pretty dull, wouldn't it? I mean, can you imagine just da, da, da. You know. Or you think of sort of like the endless church service kind of, you know. And we're going to sing again. It's like, no. You know. For the 550th time, we will sing. Can we have a new song, please? You know, it just, it's like, is that attractive? You know. A much better way of thinking of the future, a sort of term to use, is the world that we all want. Let me get into it with a quote, in fact some lyrics, by good old John Lennon. Remember, imagine no possessions, I wonder if you can, no need for greed or hunger, a brotherhood of man. Imagine all the people sharing all the world. And so on and so on. It's a wonderful picture. The rest of the song includes no more war, living in peace, great harmony, and so on. And it's a lovely little example of the longing we have for this better world, the world we all want, where all of the rubbish of life is extinguished. All that makes life miserable and hard is no longer there. Despite various hopings for utopia and heaven on earth, world poverty continues, the wars continue, the brotherhood ceases to arrive, and so on. And so while in one sense there are the dreams, the world we all want and long for, there's also the sort of the cynicism, we'll never really change the world. Yeah, sometimes might be better than others, but it just goes on and on. Well, as we just thought in the previous session, for the Christian, history is going somewhere. There's a trajectory. One day we will arrive at a destination. And that destination is the subject of this passage. Now, the book of Revelation is obviously a bit tricky in some ways. I preached all the way through Revelation and found it very difficult, but did discover a number of things. It's a very highly structured book. And it's one of those books that we need help in getting into it, I think. But actually, it's not as hard as we might think. So let me just show you one thing, for example. Just look back to chapter 17, verse 1. Chapter 17, verse 1. Earlier in the book, we had some angels introduced who had some bowls, and one of them appears here. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, "Come, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute who is seated on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed sexual immorality," and so on. Verse 3, "He carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman." So here you have an angel who has one of the seven bowls saying, "Come, I'll show you judgment of the prostitute," and he's carried away in the spirit and he sees a woman, right? Those are the elements. And later on, we are told, verse 5, that she is called Babylon. So there's a city represented there. So it's a woman or it's a city, depending how you think about it. Okay? And it's judgment. Back to our passage, chapter 21, verse 9. "Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls full of the seven last plagues spoke to me and said, 'Come away, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb.' And he carried me away in the spirit to a mountain great and high and showed me the holy city Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God." You see the paradox. Same angel saying, "Come, I will show you something." And in both cases, show you a woman. In one case, a prostitute. In one case, the bride. Also represented as cities, Babylon or Jerusalem. And I point that out to do two things. One is to say, actually, because they're several chapters apart, we miss that. And actually, in looking at this book, we need to think in bigger patterns quite often. But secondly, to say that the theme of the end of the book of Revelation is the judgment that comes on the old world in rebellion against God, pictured by the prostitute or Babylon, and the arrival of the new world, the new creation, pictured by the bride or Jerusalem. And this then tells us where God is taking the world. We'll think about it in a couple of sections. Let's think about God's restoration project, first of all. You may have noticed, as we read through, that it's a description, most of it, of the city, Jerusalem. But as I hope will be clear from what I've just pointed out, that isn't a city in the new creation. That is a metaphor for the new creation. The old creation is the prostitute or Babylon. The new creation is the bride of Christ or the new Jerusalem. So seeing this city arrive is not a city descending that's going to be the capital or something. It's seeing the new creation arrive. And it has this sense of this restoration to it. I don't know if you've ever visited a ruined abbey or a castle or something on holiday. You know, you walk around, you can still see the splendour of the place in some ways. You can see the impressive architecture. You can maybe see some carvings or something. But the things are ruined. You know, the walls are falling in. Maybe there's no roof. There's no stained glass in the windows or whatever. And you imagine casting a wand and seeing the whole thing restored, such that there is glass in the windows and chandeliers hanging from the ceilings, or whatever it is. Well, restoration and restoration of former glory is one of the feels of this passage. See, this world is like a glorious ruin. We can see some of the glories of it. The beauty and intricacy of creation. We can know it in the enjoyment and the satisfaction and enrichment of life sometimes. Life can be great. But we also see the ruin of it in the disasters and the famines and the wars, and we know and feel the ruin of it in the hardships of life. Life can be very hard. It's a glorious ruin. But God promises to restore it. We see this most clearly in the opening verses of chapter 22 with this stuff about the river of the water of life. Chapter 22, the angel showed me the river of the water of life, bright as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb through the middle of the street of the city. New Jerusalem has this river of water of life, and that river, I'll argue in a second, is a picture of God bringing fullness of life back to his creation. It actually draws on quite a lot of Old Testament promises. I'm sorry to say they haven't been part of your overview, but there we go. You know the Dead Sea? Dead Sea in Israel? Why is it called the Dead Sea? It's too salty for life. Nothing can live in it. Exactly. I'm not sure that's actually technically true. I think there's some microbe that can kind of survive or something. But basically, nothing can live in it. Too salty because all the water continually evaporates and so on. It is a picture of lack of life. Deadness. That's why it's called the Dead Sea. Well, God spoke about this new river flowing from his throne back in Ezekiel. Let me show you. Ezekiel 47, he talks about this river flowing and says, when it enters the sea, that's the Dead Sea. Right? So this river of life flowing out from God enters the Dead Sea, a picture of deadness. The water there becomes fresh, and swarms of living creatures will live wherever the river flows. So where the river flows, everything will live. So you see the picture. This river comes out from God. It comes out from his throne in the book of Ezekiel. It's obviously a metaphorical picture, but it's a picture of life flowing out from God. Wherever the river goes, it brings life instead of death. Verse 2, back in Revelation, on each side of the river stands the tree of life. That tree, of course, was originally in the Garden of Eden. And so we're being brought back in our minds to the original paradise God created. And that passage in Ezekiel speaks of this as well. It goes on in that same chapter. Fruit trees of all kinds will grow on both banks of the river. In Revelation, there is more than one tree of life. It's on both sides. Every month they will bear fruit because the water from the sanctuary flows to them. Their fruit will serve for food and their leaves for healing. And here we're told the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations, and it yields its fruit each month. And so here again is a picture of the blessing of life God wants to bring. Here in terms of kind of the nourishment of fruit or the healing from these leaves. The pain, the discord, the disease is healed. God restores his creation, brings it back to the true life he wanted it to have. And then, most poignantly, I think, verse 3, no longer will there be anything accursed, or literally, I think really, there will no longer be any curse, which again, of course, takes us straight back to Eden, where God pronounced a curse because of the rebellion. Specifically, in this case, I think the curse on creation, you know, the land being cursed and so on. And that ruin of creation we've been thinking about started at that moment and continues today and will continue until the moment where God restores it and says, no more curse, only blessing.
So does this mean that we'll actually be able to eat the fruit from the tree of life in the new creation? Is that significant?
That takes you right back to the fall where
we were forbidden.
Yeah. Well, metaphorically, yes. As in, I don't think there will be, personally, a river. I'll say more in a second about this city and what it represents, but I think it is all symbolic literature, and it's not that there will be a river and a couple of fruit trees, and we'll have to go and pick the fruit. But what it pictures clearly is God's sustaining of life, and life kind of in all its blessing and fullness that we only know a pale shadow of now. That clearly was his original intention in terms of the tree of life being there in the Garden of Eden. And the barring there, otherwise he'll reach out and eat from that. I take it as part of the punishment. It's the bringing of death and so on. So absolutely. So metaphorically, yes, we will eat from the tree of life. And I hope you can see from even this brief description of kind of, if you like, more of the sort of the physical nature of the world and this bringing of life, this whole sort of restoration, you know, the glorious ruin now restored and so on. When we think of heaven as floating around in nighties and playing harps and so on, you know, we're really off key here. And this again is one of the, you know, this is where we will hear in our culture the kind of the slight comic version of the future. I'll read Gary Larson and I'll laugh, but actually it will influence my thinking slightly. And heaven will feel like a very unreal place, a weird place. Whereas here, the new creation is linked with the first creation, real, physical, a restored version of this world. So, towards the end of the Narnia Chronicles, C.S. Lewis, in the last battle, I meant to bring the quote with me, so you'll have to get my paraphrase and memory. They're looking at what is effectively the new creation, the children. And they kind of go, aren't those the Green Mountains or something that they used to know in Narnia? Aren't they them? No, they can't be. They're different. And the reply is something like, no, it is them. And they kind of go, yeah, but they're greener and more solid or something. It's like they're them, but a perfected version of them. And that's really good. It's like, the new creation will be like this world, in a sense, the physicality of this world and the beauty of this world, but a perfected version of it. Where everything's right, where there's life instead of death, where there's healing instead of hurt, where there's blessing instead of curse. And our understanding of that future new creation has got to be held together with our understanding of the old creation we live in now, because creation itself is good. Sin has marred it and it is cursed, but it is good. And we must affirm both that creation is good and this is a fallen, cursed world. It's very easy to kind of so emphasize that it's a fallen, cursed world, we actually become a little bit anti-creation. Physical is bad, spiritual is good. And so we start to think of heaven as escaping the physical. And heaven is this spiritual only place, you know, where I'll be happy just singing songs endlessly or floating mystically. No. And actually, Christians have quite often fallen that way in church history, that we want to be released from the physical. Do you know if you've, you know, the song, There is a Day, All Creation Longs For and so on. It's a great song about heaven. There's a line in it, in the first verse, which speaks about a day of liberation for all the earth, right? Which is absolutely right, that's what we're talking about. I was singing that at a church, my old church in Cambridge actually, and somebody had obviously typed in the lyrics rather than getting them off some program, and it read, we sang a day of liberation from the earth. And I just thought that was, you know, I presume it was just an accident. But I'm sure we also all sang it thinking, great, liberation from the earth. That's not what we long for. No, not at all. We long for a day of liberation for the earth, so that it's a perfect place, not escaping the physicality of it. Now, some people will fall the other way and say, actually, there's not very much wrong with this earth. We can build heaven on earth and so on. And that's the other way we can go, and that's wrong. No, we need God to step in and transform it. We need this river of life flowing out to us. And it will remain a fallen world, cursed world, until that day. Well, let's move on. Another aspect of this passage, in fact, one of the main aspects leading up to that last section we just looked at, is the perfection of a relationship. Because God's plans aren't just about a creation and about our living in it and enjoying it. His plan is to be with his people. You see, this city, I think, actually pictures God's people. So let's think a second, away from this passage, about something else on the book of Revelation. You may know of the controversy that the number 144,000 sometimes conjures up. You've heard of the 144,000? It's mentioned in the book of Revelation. You haven't heard of it. Fine, don't worry. At various points in the book of Revelation, it talks about the 144,000. So it comes, I don't know, four or five times in the book or something. And there's quite a lot of debate. Who are the 144,000? So the Jehovah's Witnesses, for example, think that they are a special group of people who are saved, who will enjoy eternity at a sort of upper story experience of God. And everyone else will be the plebs, just having a nice experience of God, but not as good. I think that's absolute rubbish myself. One of the things Revelation does is it quite often works as a bit of an audio-visual display. And John is often told something and then sees something. Right? So the classic illustration is in chapter 5, he is told, "See, the Lion of Judah has triumphed." Right? What image does that conjure up in your mind? You're told, "The Lion of Judah has triumphed."
A lion?
A lion for a start? And? What sort of lion, Ferocious? Strong, victorious, "Then I looked and I saw a lamb looking like it had been slain." So I hear the Lion of Judah has triumphed. I open my eyes and I see a lamb who's been slain. But I take it I'm looking at the same thing. And the whole point is I have to put together what I hear with what I see and say, no, the lamb who is slain is the triumphant Lion of Judah. And of course he's triumphed by being killed. Yeah? And that happens a few times in Revelation. It's one of the ways the book works. So the first time we get the 144,000, John hears in chapter 7, there are the 144,000 gathered, 12,000 from the tribe of Dan, and 12,000 from the tribe of Naphtali, and 12,000 from here, 12 tribes, 12,000 from each, makes 144,000. In other words, all of the people of God, represented by the 12 tribes, they're all there. Brilliant, he thinks to himself. They're all here. I open my eyes. What do I see? Next line. And I saw a vast multitude that no one could ever count from every tribe and tongue and nation. So the 144,000 is just a picture of all the people of God. That's all it is. So when we get to chapter 21, that was just background, but it was fun. We get to chapter 21 and we read that this city is 12,000 stadia by 12,000, 12 times 12, 144,000, and I measure the wall, and the wall is 144 cubits. I'm thinking to myself now, this city is not just a city that happens to be this by this, with a wall this wide. This city is the people of God. It is the 144,000. It's not a building in the new creation, it's the people of the new creation. And of course, I should have been tipped off by that already, because as well as being called a city, what else is it called at the beginning? The bride of Christ. It's the church. Then represented as a city, to teach us certain things about the church in the new creation, the people of God. So, we should think of for the first part of this relationship in the new creation, as all of God's people gathered together, bound together, united together. It is not me sitting on my cloud, maybe waving at other people on their cloud. This is the perfecting of a relationship between us. And if you were at the weekend on church I did 18 months ago, whatever it was, you know, one of the things we did was look forward to the people of God perfected and how we're to represent that here on earth now. But it's not just about people in a perfected relationship. It is about God being with his people in a perfected relationship. And that idea flows all the way through. So verse 11, this city, these people, have the glory of God. Its radiance like a most rare jewel. So the people of God the people of God now shine with the glory of God. It's like his presence kind of infuses it. And that links with the next thing, which is the shape of the city. What shape is the city? It's not just a square, it's got three dimensions. Cube, thank you. 12,000 by 12,000 and 12,000 high. It's a cube. It's pretty weird. You know, show that to an architect. I'd like a city as a cube. So people, of course, have tried to draw this. You shouldn't really bother, but this is what it looks like, supposedly. There is the new Jerusalem coming down out of heaven. Okay? Looking forward to living there? No windows is all I can say, you know. Anyway. I show you that not because we ought to draw it. You really shouldn't try and draw stuff in the book of Revelation, because the whole point is you hear it's a lion who's triumphed and then you see a lamb. I mean, how do you draw that? You know? That's not how it works. I show it to you to illustrate it is a cube. Now, it's a cube. That's great, Graham. Thank you very much. So what? There's only one other structure in the Bible that's a cube. What is it? Sorry?
Numbers?
It's in the book of Numbers? It's not in the book of Numbers. Good guess, because lots of numbers. It's not the Ark of the Covenant, but it's linked with it. The Holy of Holies in the temple, where the Ark of the Covenant lived. Now, the Holy of Holies, of course, was the place where God's presence was. And you might think, well, you know, okay, it's a cube and this is a cube, so what? Well, I would argue this pretty strongly myself. In the Holy of Holies is where God himself dwells. The closer you get into the temple, the closer you get to God's presence. And of course, there are all the barriers and so on. But his presence, if you like, as he truly is restricted to one room in one building in one place on earth in the Old Covenant. And I think the reason this is now pictured as a cube, the whole new creation is now pictured as a cube, is because it plays on that and says, instead of being in a sense restricted like that, God's presence now fills all of creation the way it used to once fill that room. He is present in the new creation in a way that he wasn't back then. And that links, I add this as part of the argument, verse 22, I saw no temple in the city, for its temple is the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb. Well, the temple obviously is the place where God dwelt among his people. There's no temple now because he is there. And then verse 23, and the city has no need of the sun or moon to shine in it, for the glory of God gives its light, and its lamp is the Lamb. Now, I don't think, to be honest, that is a comment on the lighting in the new creation. It's not that God will be so bright that the hills it'll shine all the way around and we don't need a sun. Who knows if there'll be a sun? I don't know, but I think that's the point here. The point is to say that God is present in his glory in all his fullness, so that it shines throughout it. And actually, this again is only predicted in the Old Testament. Isaiah 60. The sun will no more be your light by day, nor will the brightness of the moon shine on you, for the Lord will be your everlasting light, and your God will be your glory. And the same passage talks about the gates not being shut, and there not being any night in Psalm, which again is picked up in this passage in Revelation. So all this is in fulfillment of numerous Old Testament passages. And there are lots of things like a little bit like this in describing the new creation. So back in chapter 21, for example, we're told there is no more sea. You know, you tell your children, oh, there won't be any sea in heaven. Well, they might feel a bit sad because they quite like the seaside. You know, I thought it's going to be a fun place, Daddy. Well, you know, it's not just like. It's not supposed to be telling us whether there is or isn't going to be a sun or a moon. It's not whether there will or won't be sea. You know what sea represents, particularly in the Old Testament?
Chaos,
the source of evil. To say there is no more sea is to say there is no more possibility of a source of evil or chaos. So all of this is God present, I suggest, with his people. His presence kind of shining through every nook and cranny, no darkness here. And then what's put in all these symbolic ways, verse 3 and 4 of chapter 22, the throne of God and the Lamb will be in it, his servants will worship him, they will see his face, and his name will be on their foreheads. Which I think pictures the sort of consummation of that relationship. We see God, we know him truly and fully. We know him now by his Spirit, truly. But we will see him face to face. So, where are we going? Well, the kingdom that is coming, I think I'd put in terms a little bit like this. God living in a perfected relationship with his people in his restored creation. Something like that. You could describe it in different ways. And I trust this fits with what you've been doing in overview, in terms of how God created people to be with him, in a relationship with him, in his perfect creation, how that is lost in the fall, re-established in Israel. You'll be looking at how that's established in the church, but one day it'll be perfected in the new creation. Of course you can. Yes, yes, absolutely. So we mentioned Philippians 3 earlier, that we're citizens of heaven and we eagerly await a Saviour from there who, by the power that enables him to bring everything under his control, will transform our his mortal bodies so they'll be like his glorious body, or our lowly bodies or something, so they'll be like his glorious body. Well, there's a picture of Jesus coming who can... the power that enables him to bring everything under his control so that his kingship is now not only kind of there as a fact, but it's now acknowledged and kind of enforced. Well, one way it'll be enforced over our lives is that we will be transformed so that we cannot but obey him.
And similar to our original point in creation when God made man and woman and it was good.
Yeah.
But without the possibility of ever falling.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in the sense, I mean, there are clearly great parallels, as we've seen, between Eden and here. In a sense, this is a intensified, magnified version. It's now a city rather than just a garden and so on, but there are great parallels. And yet there is also clearly the sense you can't go back now, like there's no more sea. There is no possibility of evil now. This is transformation, fully and finally. Any more questions just on that? You think of questions. I'll look at my notes and see what I haven't said yet.
So is this new creation more perfect than Eden before the fall?
Yeah, is the new creation more perfect than Eden?
And if it is, then why is that? Because Eden before the fall.
was perfect.
I mean, there's something different between Eden and this new creation.
Yeah.
I'm trying to understand exactly what that is, because it's obviously completely materially significant, because
yes.
Eden then went horribly wrong.
Yes. Yeah. Well, the big difference, I think, would have to be that there is no longer the possibility of sin. So Adam and Eve clearly had the choice under God's sovereignty to turn away. So they are given the command, do not. We are not given commands in the new creation, by the way, whatever you do, don't do this. Because we wouldn't but obey him. And to be honest, I think this is the ultimate fulfilment of the New Covenant promises. So you have looked at the New Covenant promises, haven't you, in your overview of Jeremiah 31 or whatever, that I'll write my law on their hearts. Yeah? Go on, nod at me as if you know what I'm talking about. Brilliant. Thank you. I find that really reassuring. Well, when is his law written? What is the picture of the law written on our hearts symbolize? Sorry? Yeah, I think it symbolises total obedience. That we would want, our heart's desire would be to want to obey his law. When is that fulfilled?
Doesn't it begin now? I mean, it's already happened.
Yeah. Yeah, it does begin now. It does begin now because we have the Spirit. And the new heart, a heart of flesh and not of stone, a heart with the law written on it, is tied in with the work of the Spirit. So it begins now. But it's not finished yet, is it? Because my heart all... sorry, someone's spilling sweets all over themselves at the back. An illustration of my point. Someone's heart desire is... not to listen to God's word, but... no. Sorry. My heart desire can be to obey God, but it can also be not to. So I take it that the new covenant promises are fulfilled partially in death and resurrection of Christ and the gift of the Spirit beyond that. It's the now and the not yet, the thing like before. Yes, I'm transformed. Yes, I have a heart of flesh. Do I have his law written on my heart so I obey him completely? No. But I will do then. Now, in one sense, there's a bigger question, I think, behind your question, which is kind of a kind of, why not just begin in Eden with the perfection we see here? And we know God in his sovereign foreknowledge, and so on, knows he's going to end up here. We know this will result in the glory going to his Son as the crucified Lamb who's brought about this restoration. Clearly, that's all in his big scheme, even in Eden. Why he does it, why salvation history, why history itself works in that way, rather than God just saying, you know what, I'll begin with the end point. Apart from saying it will bring glory to him, I don't think we're given an answer. Yeah, at the back.
Can I just clarify something? Is it that Spirit will not fully write Christ's laws on our heart until the new creation, or is it that he's done it now, but we will only fully obey the new creation?
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. That's a very good question. Is it that the Spirit hasn't written them fully, or that we just won't obey them fully? In one sense, I wouldn't want to push the imagery too far, because I think the image of writing on our heart is, I think, a picture of my heart desire being total obedience. I think to understand that more, we need to get into the whole sort of Spirit-flesh stuff. So Galatians 5, live by the Spirit, don't live by the flesh, which clearly shows that I now have a choice. I can walk by the Spirit who leads me to obey the law of God fully and completely, but I can continue to follow my sinful flesh. So is it that the law's written fully, but I just don't want to follow it all the time, or is it it's not quite there fully? I don't know. I think the end result is the same. But you may be right. It may be that it's there, but I have pulls away from it as well. So in which case I have a divided heart still. Yeah.
Just thinking, if I've understood it correctly, this is going to be the new Eden. This planet that we're actually sitting on right now, because God's so actually transform it and get rid of all the rubbish, this will become the new Eden.
Yeah, people. It's interesting, isn't it? Pushing the whole restoration picture. Is it this world, or does God kind of screw it all up, throw it away, and start again? Now, I think it's this world myself. There are one or two passages which would suggest not. 2 Peter 3 seems to talk about this, the elements of this world being destroyed. However, it's kind of destroyed in fire, and a standard interpretation of that is that it's being purified in fire. And I think numerous other passages like this do talk about a restoration of this actual world. And I think it's pretty easiest to see in terms of our bodies. You know, do I get a glorified version of this body? Or do I get a complete... I don't know why that's funny. Well, I can guess. Or do I get a completely new? Get a completely new body? No, I get a glorified version of this body. Jesus will transform our lowly body so they'll be like his glorious body. 1 Corinthians 15, our bodies that are sown perishable are raised immortal. Well, that means it's me, but it's a transformed me. And I think in a very similar way, it's this world, but a transformed world. One last question was over here, then we must move on.
It was kind of similar to that, asking, well, do you think the world will be completely destroyed? Because also thinking about the fact that we are mortal, and the whole way nature ties into that, you know, so there must be some quite radical changes to the nature as well, because otherwise it wouldn't work.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. It is. To be honest, it is. It can start to become a bit mind-bending, in kind of thinking, how would life work? Because if there's going to be no pain or sadness or disease or whatever, could I fall over in the new creation? Well, if yes, could I not fall over and crack my head open? And wouldn't that hurt? Well, there's no more pain. Now, at this point, I kind of end up kind of thinking, don't know. You know, just don't know. We know it's a perfected version of this creation. We should think of the similarities. We shouldn't think of some disembodied weirdo state. And yet exactly what it will be like. What creation will be like? Will there be animals around us? What will they do? Will they not eat each other? Will they not try and bite me? You know, presumably there will be radical changes in all of that. And I take it some of that is pictured, you know, Isaiah, the lion will lie down with the lamb and so on, and the child will play by the cobra's nest or whatever it is. They shall neither harm nor destroy my holy mountain, Isaiah 9. So I take it, again, metaphorical language to some degree, but I take it there is some sense in which that will be literally true. But it's very hard for us to conceive what life will actually be like. But there's enough, I think the key thing is to say, there's enough continuity that it should be recognisable life with everything that makes life good. You know, the fun of relationships and the enjoyment of work well done and the pleasures of life, all purified and heightened. And all of the stuff that makes life rubbish and disappointing and hurt and the pain and the emotional turmoil and angst, all washed away. So I'm trying to think about it in those sorts of terms. We ought to press on. You might have more questions. We'll have a chance for more questions again tomorrow. Do store some away if you want to. Let me just mention a few things from this. First of all, and then I do want to go on, unfortunately, I'm afraid, to hell in just a moment. So, if this is God's plan for the world, let me just throw out a couple of implications for us. We'll think of more implications as the weekend goes on, typically tomorrow morning. But, do we live as if this world is all there will be? Because our culture, while it will say different things about how we should live, I would suggest one of the most dominant cries of our culture, particularly for people of our sort of age, will be, you only live once. implication, make the most of it now. In fact, Karis and I just flicked on the TV last night, saw a little bit of Jonathan Ross, and he was interviewing, can't remember his name, Russell Bryan, the guy who does Big Brother's Little Brother thing, is it that? Madman, you know. Anyway, Jonathan Ross was complimenting him on how stylish he was, in all sort of like, you know, weirdy cool sort of thing. And he was saying how, and it was a very interesting moment. At one point, he said to Jonathan Ross, kind of something like, "Life is fleeting. You and I will die one day." Wasn't the sort of comment you expect on Jonathan Ross, to be honest. Particularly when someone's just being complimented about how cool they are. Implication: make the most of my cool image now. So he recognised the truth, but therefore really enjoy life because you only live once. You know, you get, and you see it all over the place. I noticed, I think it was a new mobile phone, and with which could then, you know, it could do your washing up for you as well as take pictures and everything else. It was just amazing. You know, catchphrase at the end of the advert: make the most of now. Because hey, what else is there to do but make the most of now? You only live once. And so whether it's in travelling the world or making it in business or achievements for you or even the achievement of having a lovely family life now, whatever your goals might be, do you live as if you only live once? Well, I'd suggest that the person who knows that this is where God is taking the world can sit loose to the successes of the world. It's not that we don't enjoy the world, of course we do. We don't try and escape it, but we can sit loose to what our world would want us to have and think was important. In fact, we can make sacrifices now. It doesn't matter that I don't take a year off to travel the world, and instead I take a year off to serve in inner city Birmingham. Because actually seeing all of this world now is not what it's about. I can make sacrifices now in the light of eternity. And not just that, I should rejoice in what's coming. I should say, what a wonderful day that should be. We'll think about this a little bit, about the whole sense of expectation the New Testament would expect us to have. Living in hope. We mentioned the tensions, the now and not yet, a second ago, this morning. Do we look forward to the next phase? I've been adopted, but do I look forward to my final adoption? I've been redeemed, do I look forward to the final redemption? 1 Peter 3, we've been given new birth into a living hope that can never perish, spoil or fade, kept in heaven for you. And you rejoice in this, although you may have to suffer trials now. Do we live with a living hope that I know is kept? It has that sense of, you know, if I said to my son, his birthday is coming up, I said to him, I've got your present. You know, it's on the top of the wardrobe. I've got it's kept for you for that day. That's the sense of it. You have a living hope kept in heaven for you. God has it already, as it were. It'll all happen. So do you rejoice in that, even though you may have to suffer trials now? You see, John Lennon sang Imagine because all he could do was imagine. We're not being asked to imagine anything. We're just being asked to look forward. We'll think more about that kind of tomorrow, and how all that expectation should play in to how we live. But let's move on. We need to think about hell. Because if you look down to verse 27, it says, "Nothing unclean will ever enter it, nor anyone who does what is detestable or false, but only those who are written in the Lamb's Book of Life." And the Book of Life has appeared in the book of Revelation before. It is simply the book of those who've trusted in the Lamb. And only those who trust in the Lamb are there. You can actually see the book of life back in chapter 20, verse 11. I saw a great white throne. From his presence, earth and sky fled away. The dead, great and small, stand before it. Books are opened. Those are the books which are the books of what we've done in life. But then another book was opened, that which is the book of life. And people are judged according to what they've done. But verse 15, if anyone's name was not found written in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire. So the Bible is very clear that God will judge. We'll think about judgment more this evening. But beyond that, that he will punish those whose names are not in the book of life, who do not trust in Christ. Now we should notice that hell, however conceived, is also the place that Satan is punished. So he is thrown into the lake of fire himself, back in sort of chapter 20, verse 7 onwards. And we should rid ourselves of this notion. You get it in the jokes, don't you? You know, hell is Satan's place. It's his domain. You go, oh, I've got you. I'll do what I like with you now. I'll torture you or whatever it is. You know that? Again, Gary Larson, I find quite funny. He has this picture. He has all these pictures of hell, and there are usually sort of flames in the background, and there's always a Satan figure with horns and a pitchfork and so on, presiding over it. And there's a guy holding a cup of coffee. And the caption underneath, he's got a horrible look on his face, the caption underneath says, "Dang, even the coffee's cold. They thought of everything." You know. Well, I smile at it, but the picture is Satan inflicting things on people. He's thought of everything to make your life miserable. No, it's not his territory. It is where he is punished. And those who have also continued to reject God. Now we're given a picture of this most clearly back in chapter 14. Just flick back with you to chapter 14 of Revelation. Chapter 14. So verse... No, I haven't got time, I'm afraid, to sort of set the whole context and so on here. But verse 9... If anyone worships the beast and its image and receives a mark on his forehead and his hand, he will also drink the wine of God's wrath. And that, the background there is the beast is effectively the representative of Satan, and people who are following him and have his mark are simply those who are rebelling against God. It's nothing more sinister than that, if you like. They will drink the wine of God's wrath, poured full strength into the cup of his anger, and be tormented with fire and sulphur in the presence of the holy angels and the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever, and they have no rest, day or night. And so you have the prospect of people being tormented, we're told. It's kind of the original fire and brimstone kind of passage. Those who have no rest, contrasted with those in verse 13 who were told those who die in the Lord may now rest from their labours. They are blessed. And that contrast continues in verse 14 where we have one like the Son of Man. It's Jesus returning. And he comes carrying a sickle to harvest the earth. There are actually two harvests going on. One in verse 16. Seems to be collecting kind of his people, and then one in verse 19, gathering a grape harvest and throwing it into the winepress of the wrath of God. Again, a picture of God's wrath being poured out on people. So back in verse 10, it's being tormented. In verse 9, it's being thrown into the winepress, which would have been a barrel, and being trodden down and so on. And these are the sorts of images that, of course, have made Revelation infamous. for its picture of hell. You know, you get the wine press, and you know, the juice would have flowed out of it. But verse 20, blood flows out from it. And it does seem to be pretty gory. Now, some, of course, have said that this picture of God is simply too vindictive. This is a picture of God as a cosmic sadist running a kind of eternal torture chamber. And so we can't take these pictures literally. Well, I agree, you can't take them literally. It's symbolic literature, as we have been thinking. I don't think God has a wine press ready. There isn't actual burning sulfur being stoked and so on. But although it's symbolic, it is symbolic of something. And I can only assume that these are horrific images and symbols because the reality they represent is also horrific. Now, I don't think we're given many details about what this punishment will look like. I think we're given a lot, as we've been dealing with, about the nature of the new creation. We're told, I think, comparatively little about what hell, what punishment would look like, what it actually involves. But let me just mention some of the other descriptions given, and we'll sort of build a composite picture. I mean, Jesus speaks regularly of people gnashing their teeth and weeping, which I think implies kind of remorse, anger. Jesus speaks of people saying, you know, away from me, I never knew you. Luke 13, for example, is one of the parables, you know, enter into the house, the time will come when the guy will lock the door and someone will knock and say, let me in. He says, away from me, I never knew you. Which seems to speak of exclusion from the presence of Jesus, the kind of final ending of any kind of relationship. Jesus also talks about outer darkness. This is, by the way, I think you shouldn't be, one reason we shouldn't take all these pictures literally. I mean, some of them are incompatible. I don't think you can have, you know, eternal fire and outer darkness. You know, they're metaphorical pictures. But darkness, I would suggest, represents some kind of deprivation from the light and life of God. 2 Thessalonians 1 I haven't put it up here. Forget about that. 2 Thessalonians 1, let me just read it to you. He will punish those who do not know God and do not obey the gospel of our Lord Jesus. They will be punished with everlasting destruction and shut out from the presence of the Lord and from the glory of his might. So that speaks of both punishment, it'll be a punishment. It will involve destruction, eternal, everlasting destruction, and separation, being shut out from the presence of the Lord. So my point is it has a different sort of tone in different passages. It can involve this idea of punishment or destruction. Relationally, it is that of exclusion, that is the experience of knowing God's wrath or punishment. Well, why talk about hell? Well, first of all, the Bible does, and for good reason. It is a reality, and it is a reality that can be escaped. And on the lips of Jesus, some of these strong words about hell are because he wants to warn people. We should talk about it because it's the same reason you don't wear rose-tinted glasses driving. It's not very good for traffic lights, you know. We shouldn't pretend it doesn't exist because it'll be dangerous, because Jesus is warning us. It says, danger ahead, don't head this way. We must also talk about it because lots of elements of it are denied today, as I mentioned first thing. Let me mention three aspects that are denied, and I think these kind of form the foundation of what we should teach about hell. Three important things. I think if you take away any one of these three things, kind of the stool falls over, as it were. The teaching on hell falls flat. First of all, have I put them on here? I can't remember. Yes. There will be people there, which I know is pretty obvious to say, but it needs to be said. Lots of people do still hope in a universal salvation. Some suggest hell becomes a hypothetical warning. But I would suggest, if everyone is saved, it's a meaningless warning. There will be people there. There will be conscious punishment. You may know that one of the most common denials of the traditional teaching on hell around in sort of evangelical circles today is that people simply cease to exist. The punishment is simply non-existence. It often goes under the name annihilationism, because you are annihilated, you cease to exist. It is occasionally also called conditional immortality, which is because they think that our immortality is conditional, and God simply won't grant us immortality after the last day, and so you'll simply cease to exist. Whatever you call it, I think it does contradict fundamental elements of the gospel. If hell is simply ceasing to exist, then the gospel becomes the gospel of missing out. You'll miss out on heaven. You don't have to avoid hell. Because someone's saying to themselves, I only live once. And you say, yeah. Oh, but it could be really good if you trust Jesus. And they say, well, actually, I quite enjoy my life like this. And the gospel becomes not the gospel of flee the wrath to come. The gospel becomes the gospel of missing out on a great time in heaven. And that, I think, is just a terrible distortion of the focus of the Bible. The reality is that God is the Lord of his world, who graciously calls people back to him, but he will not allow a rebellious world to rebel forever or to rebel without just punishment. Now, I should say that there are two forms of annihilationism around. One form is the form I've just mentioned, where you simply cease to exist. The other form is where there is conscious punishment of some kind, and then you cease to exist. Now, whether you believe that this punishment would end in a final destruction or not depends on a variety of texts. I would suggest the ones we've just glanced at would suggest not. It would suggest it is eternal conscious punishment. But, if I can put it this way, I've got a lot more time for that view of annihilationism than for the first one I just described. Some of you, I mentioned this because people may know, have heard things. Some people may have heard John Stott is an annihilationist. He's the second kind, not the first kind. That there will be conscious punishment. That will be terrible. But that it will not go on for all eternity. And I've got more time for that because I can understand. I have every sympathy with the emotional angst it causes us to know that people we know and love will be punished for all eternity. But what we must never do is then kind of modify it so it becomes, you know what, it won't be that bad. That, I think, is something that the Bible would never give us room to do. And lastly, there's no escape. Because the other way hell, I think, is denied in evangelical circles or on the fringes of it is what goes under the heading of post-mortem evangelization. That is, there'll be a chance after death. You die, maybe even start to experience hell and God's punishment, but a kind of you'll come to your senses. And this is in books by people that will be spoken of as evangelicals. And again, you can see the rationale in terms of, well, you finally see Jesus is exalted as Lord and you realise you're rebelling him and you're experiencing the wrath of God and you, you want to turn away from that. And so surely it'll be a case of people, hell sort of gradually emptying or something. Or it's simply at the judgment seat, you could have got a final chance before the eternal separation or something like that. Again, I just think this is a perversion and would lead people to start to ignore the severity of warnings. Hebrews 9:27. It's destined for man to die once and then the judgment. And the judgment isn't a time of decision, it's a time of verdict on people. We'll think about more of that this evening. So I take it we look forward with soberness and indeed with sadness. But we know God judges justly. We know there is no unjust punishment on that day. But we also know people we know and love will be punished. I can't remember who it was. I think it may have been Wesley or somebody. John Wesley said something like, we must always preach hell with tears. And I think that's right. There was actually a radio interview in the States by quite a provocative interviewer who's a Jewish guy who got three Christians on of different stripes, more sort of liberal through to an evangelical guy. And he said, right then, I'm a Jew. You think I'll be punished in hell. Give me one good reason why you think I should be punished in hell for not believing in your Jesus. Cuts to the chase as an interviewer. And the first guy kind of goes, well, I'm not sure we should really speak in that way, and I'm not sure that's quite what the Bible teaches, and so on, the liberal guy. And the other guy waffles a little bit. And he comes to the evangelical guy, and he starts to try and answer, and then he breaks down crying. And he cries on public radio for several minutes, and tries to start, and kind of just bursts into tears, he's sobbing. At the end of which, the interviewer said, that's the best argument I've ever heard. Which is to say that there should be an integrity about us where we weep for people and long for people to turn back to God, not a denial of these truths. I think what we need to do, what we wanted to do was have some time in RML groups. I've actually been a bit longer than I intended. I'm sorry about that. We won't have more questions now. We had some earlier. If you've got, I'm not suggesting you haven't got questions about what I've just said on hell. I'm sure you will do. Maybe we'll kick off this evening's session with questions on that. So if you've got questions on that, if you want to write anything down, if you don't want to come and put up a hand and ask it out loud, you want to write something down, do that, pass me a bit of paper, leave it on my laptop, whatever, that's fine. So we'll begin with some questions this evening. But why don't we divide into our RML groups and maybe just split into groups in this room and just take until lunch, just quarter of an hour. First of all, just to discuss what we're thinking, what we've been learning, and then just spend a bit of time praying, because it'd be good to pray some of this stuff in.